1977, or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. Right now, during our end-of-year drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $70,000 by December 31st. Make your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, it's Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, producer Freewheelin' Frank Sterling brings us more voices from our Thanksgiving Day special broadcast and talks about what Thanksgiving is to Native Americans along with the Thanksgiving myth. Also, later in the show, we present the latest episode of the Electronic Intifada podcast with host and producer Nora Barrows Friedman. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Mike Biggs. Up first on the program, producer Freewheelin' Frank Sterling brings us more voices from our Thanksgiving Day special broadcast and talks about what Thanksgiving is to Native Americans along with the Thanksgiving myth. Listen to this.
History-wise, is where we really got to look at the true meaning of Thanksgiving, and the people would really look at how it came into existence, recognizing and celebrating the massacre of 700 Indian people. That's where Thanksgiving come from. But I think if we were to take it a little bit further and we want to re-educate our people, then we would want to be, well, what is Thanksgiving? What does that mean to Native people, to indigenous peoples? Well, for me, I like to look at it not only as a day of giving thanks, but for us as Native people, every day is an opportunity to give thanks. Many of our people still do that today. Traditional people still do that. Spiritual people still do that. Spiritual leaders still do that, to greet the day. And I think Thanksgiving is an opportunity for us to begin to start that thinking process again of What is it that we're really thankful for? Are we thankful for the food that's on our table? Are we thankful for our life? Are we thankful for our health? Are we thankful for our families? What does it really mean to us? And I think as Indigenous peoples, we can help people begin to re-understand and make the connection to the land and to the Mother Earth. Because I think for me, Thanksgiving is bigger than what I just explained. It's also giving thanks for the creation, for all the things that gives us life here on this planet. And today we can look around and see all these catastrophes going on, all of these changes in the climate and the weather. Those are very significant points. Something's happening. Maybe it's because we're not giving thanks like we were giving in the beginning of time, when we were giving what we would say the original instructions of our people. Somewhere along the way, all people, we begin to lose those instructions. And for Native people, for Indigenous peoples of this land, we still have those instructions. And that is something I think we need to begin to remember and reflect on what is Thanksgiving. Well, Alcatraz, for example, started because of the Indian occupation that took place in 1969 and 1970. But it was also in solidarity of the occupation that took place of the Mayflower and the Plymouth Rock. So I hope that people that have gone to Alcatraz, people that will participate going to Alcatraz, will hopefully get that. If people have ever visited the website, they should go visit the Alcatraz website, Thanksgiving website, and see some of the stories that has surfaced over the years about people that have gone to Alcatraz and has changed their life. And people need to really look at it in that way. And to me, it's just really a reinforcing to know that this ceremony, which is a sunrise gathering, I remember 30 years ago, we couldn't even get 100 people there. Now we're getting 3,500 to 4,000 people there. That's saying something in terms of what our struggle is about and what we're trying to do here in the Bay Area, not only as a Native community, but as human beings. At first, we called it Un-Thanksgiving Day, because what we have to be thankful for other than, you know, what we're looking at today in terms of the situation, Native people, Indigenous peoples. But then we also began to think, well, now is an opportunity to educate the non-Indian people. So we decided to call it an Indigenous People's Day of Thanksgiving. And so with this is what we're bringing in our traditional people, our culture people, to give a whole new different concept and understanding of Thanksgiving, not the so-called American holiday, generic type of holiday where you sit down and have turkey and sweet potatoes, and actually to really sit down and have a healthy conversation with our family, with one another, and talk about what are we really thankful for, you know, not just our jobs or, you know, being here, but there's much more to this existence in this time of who we are in this place as Native people, as Indigenous peoples. I think that's one of the main focuses that we can contribute to the educating and probably the mending of what they call the sacred hoop. It's beginning to get back to those kind of teachings and understandings. And to me, that's what I would like to see happen on Thanksgiving and even after Thanksgiving, and you know, to revisit those kind of myths. So I hope that in the years come that we begin to really take a look at these holidays. So whether it's Thanksgiving or whether it's Columbus Day, many of the other days. I mean, right now we're talking about American Indian Heritage Week, Indigenous Peoples Days, and solidarity and all of those things. Well, let's really educate. Let's really look at what these really mean to us. Let's bring back our history, not his story, but our history. So I would like to thank people that are listening and people that are a part of this awareness and consciousness to step forward, and let's get the word out about the myth of Thanksgiving.
Yeah. thousands of years before the official Thanksgiving Day was proclaimed by Governor Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1637, North American indigenous people across the continent had celebrated seasons of Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is a very ancient concept to American Indian nations. The big problem with the American Thanksgiving holiday is its false association with American Indian people, the infamous Indians and Pilgrims myth. It's good to be thankful for your blessings. It's not good to distort history, to falsely portray the origin of this holiday, and lie about the truth of its actual inception. Here are some accurate historical facts about the true origin of this American holiday. Thanksgiving did not begin as a great loving relationship between the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag, Pequot, and Narragansett people. In fact, in October of 1621, when the Pilgrim survivors of the first winter in Turtle Island sat down to share the first unofficial Thanksgiving meal, the Indians who were there were not even invited. There was no turkey, no squash or cranberry sauce or pumpkin pie. In fact, a few days before this alleged feast took place, a company of Pilgrims led by Miles Standish actively sought the head of a local Indian chief, and an 11-foot-high wall was erected around the entire Plymouth settlement for the very purpose of keeping Indians out. Officially, the holiday we know as Thanksgiving actually came into existence in the year 1637. Governor Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony proclaimed the first official day of Thanksgiving and feasting to celebrate the return of the colony's men who had arrived safely from what is now Mystic, Connecticut. They had gone there to participate in the massacre of over 700 Pequot men, women, and children, and Mr. Winthrop decided to dedicate an official day of Thanksgiving, complete with a feast, to give thanks for their great victory. As hard as it may be to conceive, this is the actual origin of our current Thanksgiving Day holiday. Many American Indian people these days do not observe this holiday for obvious reasons. I see nothing wrong with gathering with family to give thanks to our Creator for our blessings and sharing a meal. I do, however, hope that Americans as a whole will one day acknowledge the true origin of this holiday and remember the pain, loss, and agony of the indigenous people who suffered at the hands of the so-called Pilgrims. Why perpetuate a lie? Let's face the truth of the past and give thanks that we are learning to love one another for the rich human diversity we share. Hello, welcome everyone. My name is Frank Sterling. Some of you might know me by Free Will and Franklin, and I'm here today to share with you some history and my personal story and experience with blood quantum. And I'll ask the question, what makes a person Native American? Is it culture? Is it language?
Miu yam joona, no tung rin makante yaka, no na otung sunny makante yaka.
Or is it your blood quantum? But first, what is blood quantum?
Blood quantum is a concept that's not a native indigenous concept. It's a concept created really by Europeans and European Americans. And it's really the idea that our political status and our biology are one and the same, and that they're measurable.
I'm speaking with Professor Jill Dorfler.
I'm the department head for American Indian Studies at the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota, and I'm also a first degree descendant of the White Earth Nation. I've been studying blood quantum really for a number of decades now. It's something that I worked on for my dissertation topic, and I've written broadly on this issue.
Professor Dorfler believes that blood quantum exists in name only and as a concept, but it's not real.
Of course, we know today that there is actually no such thing as blood quantum. It isn't a real thing, but it's something that was utilized by the U.S. for a wide array of purposes.
Blood quantum, or Indian blood laws, are a part of the United States and its history. Blood laws were enacted by the American government to set a legally defined outline for racial populations. For African Americans and descendants of slaves, the blood quantum was one drop. One black ancestor, or one drop of African blood, and you could be considered black. For Native Americans, we had and have to prove how much blood we have. Why the difference?
To me, what it shows us is the real political and economic purposes behind the idea of blood quantum. It further shows us that blood quantum, A, isn't a real thing, and that B, it doesn't have any real meaning. And we can see that in many ways, but in one way by these very opposing ways in which it has been used by the U.S. government. So as you said, on one hand, to classify as many people as possible as African American so that the U.S. could extract labor from them, keep them in a lower position in American society, and exploit them. On the other side, American Indians needing to be a minimum of one quarter because the U.S. wanted to have less people qualify as American Indians so that they could, by their rationale, justifiably obtain land and reduce that financial obligation, Indian Health Services, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, etc. If there are no Native people, then all of those obligations go away. And so we see then that blood quantum has been used in these two opposing ways to benefit a few people in the U.S. and to exploit others.
The U.S. government says blood quantum laws were created to help define Native American status by using fractions of our Native American ancestry, or our blood quantum. But basically, when you look at blood quantum laws, it's a way, at least on paper and in legal terms, to exterminate Native American tribes. They do this by claiming there's not enough blood of their original ancestors in their veins to be an Indian. Am I being paranoid? Again, Professor Dorfler.
When it comes to American Indians, blood quantum has primarily been used by the U.S. government as a way to limit and reduce the number of people who have that political status. The U.S. has used it to fulfill that long, old, really old idea that Indians are going to disappear. Under blood quantum, that would happen. Really, the primary purpose of blood quantum from the U.S. government standpoint, like I said, to reduce and eliminate the number of Native people.
To reduce and eliminate. What does that mean for my family and my tribal people? From my father's side, I'm an enrolled member of the Rincon Band of San Luiseno Indians. At least, that is the name the Spanish missionaries gave us. Before that, we were known as Payamquishum, or People of the West. Our tribe is made up of seven bands. The band I belong to, Rincon. Then there's La Jolla, Paula, Palma, Pechanga, Saboba, and one more, San Luis Rey, which is not federally recognized. Right now, there are only around 500 enrolled members in the Rincon Band. That's my band, only 500 members. My dad is 3/4 Luiseno blood, but only 3/8 Rincon blood. But because we can only claim one tribe, to the U.S. government, my dad is only 3/8 Native American. Then this mathematical delusion of our blood is passed down through descending generations.
So again, we're back to the reduce and eliminate that Professor Dorfler spoke of. I am almost half Native American, but only 1/8 Rincon, as is my sister. But any generations past us will not meet the 1/8 requirement by Rincon to be enrolled members, and therefore not counted by the U.S. government. I caught up with my dad and my nephew making a home repair at my dad's house, and I asked them what they thought about us, my dad, my sister, and myself being considered part of the tribe. But because of blood quantum, my nephew, his sister, and their kids are not.
It doesn't have to do with blood. I am the new tribe, technically. So it actually bothers me because eventually, over time, we're going to go extinct.
The thing is you can't just let it go. You can't just say we have no more blood to pass out. Our blood is drained. So what are we going to do? Turn it into a dust bowl, Rincon, and that's it? What happened to the Rincon Luseno Indians?
We are the Rincon Luseno Indians now.
That's now.
That's now. That's who we are. I would be a full tribe member, even though I'm not a full-blooded Native American, but they would consider me part of the tribe,
yes,
because I was born into the tribe.
If they only continue to go with blood quantum,
which was something invented by the government to make us go extinct.
But it doesn't.
Eventually, they're going to own all of our land and all of our money because they're going to quantum us out.
Not being counted as part of the tribe or an official tribal member affects Native Americans in many ways. In the case of many tribes across the country, when gaming was legalized for Indian tribes, many tribes that were once otherwise without resources were able to give their members benefits. Sometimes this was financial and could be thousands of dollars a year, or full health care, vision, and dental coverage. There might even be grocery cards, home improvement financing. So with my nieces and nephews working full-time jobs, one even working two jobs trying to survive in the Bay Area housing market, what would it mean if they were receiving this assistance?
It would affect my life greatly to have extra money. At the same time, I think there's more of a point to be made there of not belonging to the tribe and your inheritance and they're going extinct in the long run is actually kind of sad, you know what I mean? Like, we're not going to exist anymore.
And that's where Professor Dorfler agrees. We need to think of tribal citizenship in a different way.
Sort of divorce it from entitlements and really think about citizenship in form of identity and political participation. That's the heart of who we are and our nations. If we don't have any citizens, we don't have people who can vote in elections, and we don't have a government, right? The main thing is really that identity and belonging and that political status of being recognized as American Indian.
Hearing from my dad, my nephew, and Professor Dorfler, it got me thinking about something that I think is at the heart of this. How did the Rincon Band of Luseno Indians adopt blood quantum? And what does it mean to accept more tribal members? To get some more information, I reached out to Laurie Gonzalez of the Rincon Tribal Council.
Okay, well, obviously I'm a Rincon Luseno, very proud of that. I am on tribal council towards the end of my fifth term. I am also on the Rincon Culture Committee and have been since 97.
Councilwoman Gonzalez says that through the 30s and 40s, the Rincon people were counted as part of the Mission Indian Census. Then those census numbers were carried over to what is called the base roll. Starting in the 1950s, blood quantum started to be pushed on Rincon by the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
So at that time, the BIA agents came around and said, well, in order to really be a tribe, you need to have your constitution, or in our case, articles of association, which are really a form document. Here's the document, fill in the name of your tribe, and then sign off, and now you're official, and we can start distributing whatever it is that the federal government is going to give to you. On that form was a blood quantum amount, and for us it was set at 1/8.
Councilwoman Gonzalez also says that while searching for solutions, tribal governments must prepare. Once you open up to more members, you have to be able to provide equally for all of them. There is no partial membership.
Medical insurance for everyone. Because if you're a member, you're entitled to it. Can we still maintain our own fire department and our own ambulance and our own paramedics to take care of our people that are here? And do we even have enough land base to welcome them all back?
What are we going to do now seems to be the big question. Indian nations are no longer bound by blood quantum laws. We are free to choose our own path. There are many different solutions. We could allow only 3 generations of a family enrolled at one time: the children, the parents, and the grandparents. The most common way seems to be lineal descent from your ancestors. If your grandma or your grandpa or your parents were an enrolled member of the tribe, then you are too, and so are your kids. Because in the end, it's about belonging to an original culture. And what would it mean if we were to disappear?
It's not a blood quantum thing, it's a way of life, more like, you know what I mean? It's our inheritance is what it actually is.
The Indian people have gone through atrocities that they don't need to go through anymore. And it would be an atrocity to say the Rincon Lasanya Indians are long gone now because we have no more blood. That you might as well just take us and annihilate us like you used to do way back when. You can't do that. You're killing a people is what you're doing.
Bottom line is, this would be a sad world without us. The protectors, the water protectors, the earth protectors, you know, the people that have always been here. I mean, the face of your so-called stereotypical stoic Indian is constantly changing. We're not in front of barber shops, and we are not just hunting and gathering on the reservation. We're graduating from universities. We're becoming politicians. These are things that our grandparents never thought could be achieved. So these generations are going to redefine exactly what an American Indian is.
This has been Free Will and Franklin for KPFA Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to all my guests, Professor Jill Dorfler, Larry Gonzalez, my dad Frank Sr., and my nephew Josh. The instrumental music used in this piece was from Basement FM. That's BASS Basement FM on YouTube. Hati Acham. Good night, everyone.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Up next on the program, the latest episode of the Electronic Intifada Podcast.
Regardless of what the details of this contract is, by providing tools to an apartheid settler colonial entity, Google is enabling, and not only enabling, but profiting off of violence against Palestinian people.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada Podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows Friedman.
And I'm Asa Winstanley.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada Podcast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. At the end of August, Google worker Ariel Corin announced that she was quitting the tech giant over what she says was a hostile work environment, retaliation, and illegal actions by the company. She also became a vocal protester of Project Nimbus, a $1 billion contract between Google, Amazon, and Israel to build data centers in Israel on behalf of the Israeli military and government. Corin and other tech workers started speaking out about the contract, and Ariel says that Google retaliated by trying to force her out of her position. Last year, as Jonathan Cook wrote for the Electronic Intifada, Two employees at Google and Amazon went public about Project Nimbus, and in their letter to The Guardian, quote, gave examples of how Israel would be able to use Amazon and Google's computer services to help enforce the occupation. Data would be used to identify Palestinian homes for demolition in what are often moves toward land clearances by Israel to build or expand illegal settlements. The data would also be used to guide attacks on Gaza, as well as assist Israel's Iron Dome missile interception system. The employees added that Google and Amazon will be directly implicated in Israel's wider apartheid policies, with Project Nimbus serving the Israel Lands Authority, which not only allocates lands for illegal settlements, but oversees discriminatory policies in land allocation inside Israel that openly privileges Jews over the fifth of the population who are Palestinian natives. Since Ariel Korin quit and went public about her refusal to aid and abet Israel's apartheid system with Google and Amazon technology, tens of thousands of people have signed a petition calling for no tech for apartheid. There was a day of action in Seattle in September, where tech workers in New York City, San Francisco, Durham, and Seattle escalated the pressure on their companies to drop the contracts with Israel. Joining us to talk today to talk about this is Ariel Korin and Amazon worker Batul Sayed, both with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. Ariel and Batul, it's so good to have you with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you.
So Ariel, let's start with you. Let's get into what Project Nimbus is. And it should be noted that just after you went public with your resignation, Google put out a statement denying that its products would be used to aid intelligence services or bolster the military. The company spokesperson said that the contract, quote, is for workloads running on our commercial platform by Israeli government ministries, such as healthcare, transportation, and education. And they said that these protesters were misunderstanding the contract. But Israel itself has boasted that, quote, the project is intended to provide the government, the defense establishment, and others with an all-encompassing cloud solution. And recently, Google was forced to admit that this is indeed the case. Can you bring us up to speed here and tell us what Project Nimbus is and why you decided to quit in protest?
Yes, as you mentioned, Project Nimbus is a $1.2 billion contract between Google, Amazon, and the Israeli government, and includes the Israeli military as one of the beneficiaries. Google and Amazon have, under this contract, no right to regulate which agencies within the Israeli government can become beneficiaries of the contract or have access to the tools that are built out through the contract. So an example is that the ILA, or the Israel Land Authority, which is the agency responsible for illegal settlement expansion, is one of the beneficiaries of the contract. Another thing that we find to be extremely concerning is that there is actually a clause within the contract that stipulates that Google and Amazon have no right to pull out of the contract, even in the event of worker protest or boycott pressure. So essentially, the contract is kind of like self-built to self-insulate against any sort of, any sort of voices of opposition or folks who try to hold Google and Amazon accountable to holding the Israeli government accountable for the way that they use tools. And in the event that the Israeli government uses the tools provided by Google and Amazon, which are extremely powerful AI tools, to violate Palestinian human rights, you know, the company's hands are tied. They're wiping their hands of any sort of responsibility to regulate the way that the tools get used. So these are some of the extremely concerning facts about this contract. As you mentioned, Amazon had not provided a statement at all about Project Nimbus until very recently. Google had provided a statement, but was essentially gaslighting, you know, thousands and thousands of members of the general public, its own shareholders, its own users, and its own workforce by saying that, you know, the protesters and the folks who have been speaking out about Project Nimbus have been, quote unquote, misguided. They've been denying the fact that this is indeed a military contract, right? It is a contract that is with the Israeli government, through the contract, they are going to be providing AI tools to the Israeli military. Google has been denying this for a very long time, which constitutes gaslighting, essentially, because we know, you know, this has been reported on extensively at this point, the fact that the contract actually is going to be benefiting the Israeli military, and that the military will have essentially unrestricted access to whatever tools it needs through Project Nimbus. One of the really big recent kind of victories that we had as part of the No Tech for Apartheid campaign is that hundreds of workers and community organizers and activists walked out of Google and Amazon and protested outside, as you mentioned, in four different cities outside of the Google and Amazon offices. And immediately following these protests, Google finally admitted on record that the military was actually going to be a beneficiary of Project Nimbus. And, you know, something that we emphasize a lot is that we don't believe that Google should be contracting with governments and militaries that are violating human rights, right? Regardless of what the details of this contract is, by providing tools to an apartheid settler colonial entity, Google is enabling and not only enabling, but profiting off of violence against Palestinian people. But the fact that Google is actually providing tools to a military that is violating human rights and breaking international law on a daily basis is certainly cause for added concern. And that's why that is a huge piece of the motivation behind the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. It's holding companies like Google and Amazon accountable because they're large companies. They're supposed to be a public good. They're ubiquitous companies that most if not all people of internet access are using. And they shouldn't be contracting in a way that's unregulated and unrestricted with powerful militaries, really with any militaries, period. So this is, you know, this is kind of some context around the concerns that we have.
And Batul, you currently work at Amazon and you're part of the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. Can you talk a little bit about what it's been like working, with activists, tech workers, and what the company's response has been thus far, if there's been any response?
Absolutely, yeah. It's been really encouraging to see the engagement of workers throughout this period of time that we've been working on the campaign. We started back in May of 2021, and you know, we really had a dream of having live in-person actions, never knowing if that's something that we would be able to get workers to engage with. So it's been wonderful to see that we've had that continued and sustained support by workers along with the public. Another thing that's been huge for us in the workplace is, although there have been, and we've been fully inspired by workers, tech workers in the past who have done similar campaigns like the We Won't Build It campaign, against facial recognition technology, campaigns against contracts with ICE and police and others like that, and have come together in the past. But this specific issue about the harm that tech is doing to Palestinians has not been spoken about in the corporate workplace at this scale. So being able to do that is really big for us, to know that this is something that we can talk about not only in the workplace, but as workers, we can also talk about outside of the workplace as well and have that engagement from other members of the community. One thing that was huge to us as well is seeing the progression from a small group of workers to a larger group of workers up to the shareholder resolutions, which maybe we'll talk about further later, but that were brought up earlier this year, which was the first time that Israeli apartheid was named in resolutions like this. So that's been great. In terms of response from the companies, we really haven't had much of any. At Amazon specifically, we haven't heard from leadership in response to the letter around Nimbus that was sent last year, almost exactly a year ago. We still haven't heard anything till this day. We haven't heard from the initial petition that we sent in May either. And it's been pretty much radio silent. We haven't heard anything kind of for the contract as much as we haven't heard anything against it from leadership from that corporate perspective. So we really have no idea where they stand. And as workers, it is disheartening to see that so many of us have raised this issue and have seen a complete lack of response from leaders.
Yeah, I mean, and they're probably just hoping that it goes away, right? That protesters just get bored.
Just to add one thing to the credit of Batul and the other Amazon workers who have been organizing, you know, there's definitely been a discrepancy in terms of the reactions between both companies. Google has engaged in, unfortunately, a violent way towards workers, but they've at least engaged. But, you know, one thing that's really important to highlight is that Amazon workers have been mobilizing alongside Google workers to the exact same extent. And Amazon finally did provide a statement after the protest, which was huge. We've been waiting for a statement from Amazon for a really long time. And they actually did come out with their first public statement immediately following the protest as well. And it shows that, you know, worker organizing works. We are applying the kind of pressure we need to be applying, and we're hoping for more of that to come as well.
What did the statement exactly say? Did it acknowledge that Project Nimbus is going to be a tool to aid and abet Israel's apartheid system?
It was a very interesting statement, actually. So it didn't really acknowledge anything about the contract specifically. The statement said that their AWS is committed to offering their technology to all customers worldwide. So that was kind of the piece, that's the extent of what they said about the contract itself, so very vague. The other piece, interestingly enough, that they shared in their one and only statement was that they support workers' right to say what they want, which is not something that we ever expected. That they would come out in a statement to actually put, you know, pen to paper and say that. So that was, that's also been an interesting thing that's recently developed.
And Ariel, you were forced out and in a retaliatory way by Google, in a way that, I mean, you know, when we talk about this as not just a matter of a principled protest, but it's also a labor issue. Can you talk about the way you were treated at Google, and for being outspoken as an anti-Zionist Jewish worker who opposes this contract? Can you talk about a little bit about what happened?
Yes. We have been organizing around this issue for a long time. And when I say this issue, it's this contract, it's Project Nimbus, but it's broader than just Project Nimbus, because this is really just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Google's complicity in Israeli apartheid violence. There's just a very deep-seated, deeply ingrained history of repression and censorship of Palestinian voices, mostly folks who are Palestinian with the company, but also all voices that seek to express solidarity with Palestinian people across the company. You know, we see folks being issued HR warnings on a regular basis just because they share news about what's happening in Palestine, or people who are reprimanded, who are, you know, there are actually kind of material, there are material impacts on people's career opportunities, mobility within the company, and just a very, very deeply entrenched culture of retaliation against Palestinian folks and all folks who act in solidarity with Palestinian folks within the company. So this has been something that we've been organizing on for a long time. When we initially kind of started, for myself as an anti-Zionist Jew and many other folks who are anti-Zionist, be it because they're anti-Zionist Jewish folks or Palestinian folks or just folks who feel that they want to act in solidarity with Palestinian people, the moment that we really felt that we needed to start to kind of bring that part of ourselves to work was in May of 2020. It was amidst the Black Lives Matter uprisings, and the company Google had issued a donation to the Movement for Black Lives, which many folks felt was kind of, it was a good thing in the sense that it was kind of the bare minimum that Google could have done at that moment, really the bare minimum. And unfortunately, myself and every other Jewish employee within the company received an email where the company was formally apologizing for the Movement for Black Lives donations. And when we read, you know, like, why were they apologizing for that? We learned that the Jewish ERG, which is called, ERG means Employee Resource Group. So it's kind of like a set of different groups that are meant to represent folks who have a marginalized identity, right? So there's a lot of examples. There's the Muslim Googlers Network, there's the Black Googlers Network, there's like the Gaglers, which serves as a space for like LGBTQ Googlers, right? These are just like different examples. What we learned is that the Jewish ERG, called the Jugglers or the Jewish Googlers, had issued a formal complaint to the company stating that the Movement for Black Lives donations had been anti-Semitic because of the fact that the Movement for Black Lives had expressed solidarity with the Palestinian cause. And as a result, Google was issuing a formal apology for that, essentially saying that we're sorry that this was anti-Semitic. So we were just horrified.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
It is unbelievable. And it was really, really horrifying. And so we immediately organized a petition calling on company leadership to rescind their apology and to stand firmly by their donation with the Movement for Black Lives. And instead of doing that, they responded by issuing, amidst the uprisings, they issued a $400,000 formal company donation to a group of four different right-wing non-Black groups.
And they said that the reason they were issuing this donation was in the name of fighting anti-Semitism. But these groups were all aligned with the Trump administration. They were all under right-wing leadership. All of these groups had as their kind of core organizing pillar support for the Israeli occupation, support for the Israeli military. They all had formal relationships with the Israeli military. And it was extremely concerning. So that was kind of like the point at which we started organizing. And it was over a year later during the uprisings in Palestine and the escalating violence during which over 250 people were killed by Israeli military violence in Gaza, at which point we learned that Google was kind of silently and secretively rolling out a $1 billion contract where they were going to be profiting off of fueling this military violence. And that for us was a moment where we really ramped up our organizing and realized we needed to focus our efforts on the contract. So that's just kind of some background. And in terms of the retaliation, myself, Batul on the Amazon worker side, and Gabriel, who's another Google worker, the three of us were kind of like the three workers who originally went public to oppose these contracts. And immediately afterwards, Google communicated to me that they had decided to relocate my role overseas, effective immediately. I was at the time based in San Francisco. And they told me that I was needed urgently in the Sao Paulo, Brazil office, and that I would have 17 business days to confirm my move, to accept that move. And if not, you know, I would be out of the job, essentially. And this was in the middle of the pandemic. It was in the middle of the surge of Omicron. Folks from the Brazil office were all working from home. So the, you know, this purported business urgency around me being in Sao Paulo was just completely baseless. There was really no foundation on which to argue that this was justified by business. And when I brought, you know, the news about this occurring to all of my coworkers, their immediate response was, this is very clearly retaliation. And so that was kind of, that's kind of the background of what happened.
And since you publicly left, has there been any further communication from Google HR or anything, or they were just like, fine, you're gone and that's it?
Well, my initial response was to reach out to my coworkers, folks who are also members of the Alphabet Workers Union, and just folks I had been organizing with, in addition to just people who were on my team. And I told them, you know, I think I'm going to have to leave the company. Like, they've made it really clear, if I don't accept the move to Sao Paulo, I will have to leave. And I didn't have, you know, it just didn't make sense for me. It wasn't feasible for me to move my life to a different hemisphere in the middle of the surge of Omicron. So I just thought I was going to have to leave. But people encouraged me, you know, you should really fight this. You should not accept this. And it was that encouragement that kind of gave me the wherewithal to move forward and to fight this case. So, you know, my coworkers organized a petition internally. There are now over 800 folks from within Google who have signed the petition, calling on Google to rescind that act of retaliation. And over 25,000 people signed a public petition to the same effect. So I think we did really everything we could. And I was fighting, you know, this all occurred in November. I resigned, I guess now it's a little over a month ago. So we were fighting this for almost a year. And unfortunately, the company just refused to budge and became increasingly hostile towards me. And so it became clear that I was gonna have to resign at that point.
Amazing. Batul, I want to come back to you. Ariel was talking about, in the broader sense, how tech giants like Google and Amazon claim that they're serving people in ethical ways while pursuing these contracts with Israel. But it's not, you know, it's just like, this is just what we do as a company. We, you know, all anywhere, everywhere around the world, anyone can use our services, sort of, you know, remark. But as journalist Jonathan Cook wrote for us a year ago, quote, pressure may be mounting on many companies to distance themselves from Israel over its occupation and apartheid policies. But for Amazon and Google, it is those very practices of occupation and apartheid that are a tech seam waiting to be mined. Can you talk about this and kind of the, you know, this explosion of tech contracts with Israel in partnership with Amazon, Google, you know, other, you know, weapons companies and, you know, Hewlett Packard, for example, all these biometric engineering technologies that are contracted with the Israeli military. Can you talk a little bit about Israel as this, you know, this tech seam waiting to be mined, and how companies like Amazon are looking at that?
Yeah, that's a super interesting question. I think we see often within the tech world generally, and even when I used to live in the Bay Area, so in that kind of Silicon Valley community, what is often talked about in regards to Israel and tech is the innovations that Israel has come up with, the startups having the most unicorns, all of those kinds of things, right? And I think for companies, they see that in one light. They don't look at what the technology may be used for. That's one of the biggest things that we have discussed and is in all of the letters and things that we've published, is that the tech is not the issue. The tech inherently is not the problem. And actually, we believe the tech could do a lot of good, but it's what it's being chosen to be used for. And what the companies, I think importantly in this case, what the companies are allowing for it to be used for without any type of control, any overseeing any of what it can be used for in terms of violence, increased discrimination against Palestinians in their own homes, in their own land. But we don't talk about any of that, right? When it comes to Israel and tech, we only talk about the AI tools. What are the AI tools used for? That's not an aspect that is discussed at all. So I think it's very one-sided when it comes to Israel and tech in general. And for these companies, of course, you know, there is that financial boost for them as well for entering into contracts like this, knowing the market that they're entering there. So it's very one-sided, and it's also very kind of tunnel visioned in a sense that it's not looking at what the broader repercussions can be for entering into contracts like this, let alone against Palestinians in Palestine, but the precedence that this also sends for contracts that they can have in the future with other militarized groups and the harms that can have overall.
Yeah. Let's go back to the day of action that was planned across the U.S. that was led by tech workers. What's happened since those days of actions, and what's next for the No Tech for Apartheid movement? How is this campaign growing, and what are the next steps?
Yeah, so with the day of action, it was a wonderful opportunity for us to be able to reach more people. A lot of times, you know, we kind of struggle, and I think a lot of times activism is like this, specifically kind of activism in the workplace or corporate activism, whatever you want to call it, where we feel a lot of times like we're only able to reach a certain group of people who may have already wanted to be engaged already. That being said, the Day of Action was a wonderful tool in spreading the message to people who may not have heard about this, who may not, you know, a lot of us, we only found out about Nimbus by chance. It's not something that's been greatly publicized. So even opportunities, you know, like this, Nora, are super helpful for us to be able to reach other people. But there's something special about having it live and in person and seeing people. And if you're walking by kind of wondering what's that about, and then you go and you Google, of course you have to use Google, right? And then you figure out what it was, right? There's a lot of just overall unawareness about what Israel does, I think, generally amongst a lot of these groups of tech workers. So this is, I think, an avenue for them to start to become aware of what's happening. We've also seen since then, we've had more workers who were actually public on the day of action itself, who spoke at the actions, who hadn't previously done that, which is huge, of course, for them to actually use, you know, it's not even just behind a screen, they're actually live and in person speaking against this. And workers since then have been reaching out. We've been able to get in touch with a lot more workers who are really excited to be a part of this and really want to help push the companies to end these contracts and others like them. So we have been able to work with more workers since then and are really just looking at ways that we can continue to expand this. You know, we're looking at students There is, as part of the No Tech for Apartheid campaign, there is a student pledge to not take jobs at Amazon or Google. So worker students who are potential workers, of course, like the largest pool of workers that Amazon and Google have, especially as they want at a low cost, are now encouraged to not take those jobs due to this contract. So there's just multiple different ways that we're starting to get more involved with, or that we have been, but are now seeing more opportunities to get involved with other parts of the community and get more tech workers brought in. But I'll let Ariel speak on anything else.
Fully agree with everything that Batul just said. You know, I think Google was kind of attempting to sweep things under the rug and to portray this as being, you know, a small group of workers, a very marginal, you know, group of workers. And I think with their act of retaliation, their attempt was, oh, let's get rid of this worker who spoke out, and we can kind of scare the rest of the workforce into silence and keep this, you know, tucked away. And the opposite has occurred, because when Google sought to retaliate against me, workers did not get scared into silence. Instead, they became activated. They became additionally and increasingly angry about Project Nimbus and about Google's culture as a whole. Google has this culture of repressing any sort of opposition to Google's complicity in Israeli apartheid violence. And now all of these voices that Google was trying to silence are now coming to the forefront. And I think, you know, when the week that I resigned, there were 15 Google workers who shared out anonymous testimonies, most of whom were Palestinian. Others were Arab and Muslim and anti-Zionist Jewish allies to Palestinians who are workers also within Google, who shared their firsthand accounts of being silenced at the company. There were folks who shared, there was one story of an incredible friend and coworker of ours, who's a Palestinian coworker, who was literally reprimanded just for wearing keffiyeh in the workplace, for wearing traditional Palestinian clothing in the workplace. They were literally told that they had to, you know, remove their picture that was on their internal team page because of the fact that they were wearing Palestinian clothing. There was another worker who just wrote a message, you know, free Palestine, in their internal company bio. And many people share out messages in their internal company bios. That's not out of the ordinary, but they particularly put a message in support of Palestinian freedom. They were issued a formal warning by HR, and ultimately, when they refused to remove it, their bonus was taken away and they were given a performance deduction on their performance evaluations. So, you know, there were just so many stories that people were bravely sharing out about their experiences. One Palestinian coworker wrote, "It's impossible to express any sort of disagreement with the war waged on Palestinians without being called into HR with the threat of being issued a formal warning and being retaliated against." That's kind of quote unquote quoting this Palestinian coworker from Google. So there were 15 folks who are bravely sharing these stories, and they're representing hundreds more. And then the following week, we now have this day of action, where we have four mass protests, these huge protests with this huge turnout, and all of these workers chanting and marching and screaming in the streets, holding Google and Amazon accountable. And so I think the biggest impact here is that this is no longer just like one or two or three workers speaking out. There are 10 workers who are public, but there's over 1,000 workers at Google who have put their names on a petition. And there are hundreds of workers who are starting to become activated around this. And so it's become really clear that if Google continues to try to sweep this under the rug, the voices of the workforce will get louder and louder, and we're not going anywhere until Project Nimbus does. You know, we're not going anywhere, and this movement is here to stay until something happens.
Ariel Koren and Batul Sayed, if people want to engage with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign, send it to their friends and family members who may be workers at Amazon and Google, where can they go?
There's two places I think that I would first recommend. One is the notechforapartheid.com website, where you can read more about the campaigns, you can sign on yourself, find publications, all those things. The second is a worker-led Twitter account, which is @DropNimbus. And there we'll be sharing updates and amplifying other voices and all of those things in real time.
And just the one thing to add is bit.ly, right? Mm-hmm. /Google-voices. You can actually read and please amplify the voices of Palestinian Google workers who have shared out their experiences and their stories, because, you know, I think the biggest tool that Google has in its toolkit right now is the suppression and the silencing of Palestinian voices within the company and voices that act in solidarity with Palestinians. And so, you know, to the greatest extent possible, we need to amplify these stories and these voices and show Google that we will be holding them accountable.
And we'll have all of those links up on the blog post that accompanies this podcast episode on the Electronic Intifada. Ariel Koren and Batul Sayed, thank you so much for all that you're doing and all that you've done already. And we will stay in touch and keep on this story. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having us.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, continuing Saturday.